From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And here's a taste of what's on the political menu this week. Paul Manafort's trial continues. The former Trump campaign chair is facing charges of financial crimes. His close second-in-command is set to testify against him. Four states prepare for midterms tomorrow, and Ohio holds a special election for a new representative. And there will continue to be analysis of the president's tweet yesterday, in which he confirmed that his son's 2016 meeting in Trump Tower was to get information on an opponent from a Russian lawyer. Trump said this a year ago, but it was knocked back then by his then-spokesperson, Sean Spicer, and his son, who said the meeting was about Russian adoption. The president and his lawyers also said this weekend that that meeting was legal. Ron Elving is NPR's senior Washington editor and correspondent. Ron, nothing much going on this week.
Another week.
Yeah, start with Trump's tweet.
Summer doldrums.
Right. There used to be. Start with Trump's tweet yesterday. What's the significance of this?
The president and his campaign, as you said, initially downplayed this, and we now know that was a lie. Later on, the president waffled on that in various forums. Yesterday, in a tweet that the world could see and read, he explicitly said the meeting was about getting dirt on Hillary Rodham Clinton from a Russian lawyer who was peddling it as such, and said that there was nothing wrong with that, but then quickly added, he didn't know about it at the time. So if there's nothing wrong with it, why wash your hands of it?
Yeah. Well, the president and his lawyers insist that the campaign didn't break any laws. Here's Trump lawyer Jay Sokolow on ABC's This Week yesterday.
When you look at a meeting, George, that took place in a year before the, or not 2 years ago, the question is, what law, statute, or rule or regulation has been violated? Nobody's pointed to one.
Well, in fact, many are pointing to possible campaign finance law infractions. You're not, you can't take anything of value from a foreign entity. We're going to be speaking to a legal expert on the program about that. But there's also a possible obstruction of justice, lying to Congress, and testimony. What are your thoughts here?
It is illegal under our election laws for foreign governments or foreign agents to make contributions to our federal elections. Now, that includes non-cash contributions of value, and courts have been quite generous in defining what is a contribution of value. I think it's quite clear that everyone involved in this meeting thought something of value was being discussed. And if this kind of an offer is made, an offer of something illegal, meeting with someone to discuss it could be called conspiracy. Now, the president continues to say there was no collusion, and he adds quickly, that collusion is not a crime. That's something he didn't used to say, but now he is saying if there were collusion, which he says there wasn't, that is not a crime. Be that as it may, conspiring with someone to break the law, and the Russian role here would be against the law, conspiring with that person is a crime.
Well, okay, that will be much dissected this week. But the president also stumped for Ohio congressional candidate Troy Balderson over the weekend. Here's the president at a Columbus rally talking about Republican competition in the midterms.
If the Democrats get in, they're going to raise your taxes. You're going to have crime all over the place. You're going to have people pouring across the border. So why would that be a blue wave? I think it could be a red wave. I tell you what, really, I think it should be a red wave.
Yet, in this special election tomorrow, and again, it's the congressional candidate from the Republicans, Troy Balderson, up against the Democrat, Danny O'Connor. Republicans have poured millions into this race. It's usually a safe red seat. Polls show it's neck and neck.
Yes, this is a district north and east of Columbus, which is the state capital, and it is a highly Republican district. Donald Trump carried it by 11 points. It also at one time was the seat of John Kasich when he was a member of Congress. So you've got a lot of Republicans there who are John Kasich Republicans. Kasich's not a big Trump fan. But the hardcore Republican in this district is a rural Republican. And so here's the irony. In 2018, the big subject in our politics is obviously Donald Trump. He energizes people on the right. He energizes Democrats and progressives as well. And so here in a district where you would think you would want to have the John Kasich kind of Republicans stay on board and vote with the Trump Republicans, the president came in over the weekend to energize his people, the rural Republican voters, the people that he is counting on most to reelect him in 2020. doing that may turn off some of the John Kasich Republicans and make them feel a little bit less like voting for Troy Balderson, or that's the theory and the strategy for the Democrats.
Okay, we'll see what happens tomorrow. Finally, today, day five of the Manafort trial. And we might hear from Manafort's former associate Rick Gates as soon as this afternoon. He's been cooperating with Bob Mueller's special investigation. He's already pled guilty. This could be very interesting.
Rick Gates is the key point. He's the pivotal point, the linchpin of this trial. The prosecution has already put out a lot of evidence that Manafort made millions, moved them around to fool people about their source, defrauding banks, hiding them from taxation. And what we're expecting from Gates is that he'll give us a great deal more detail, and he will tell us perhaps a little bit more about the cast of characters, the sources of that income. And the defense is going to try to paint Gates as the bad guy who did all the bad stuff and hid the money even from Paul Manafort, whom they will claim was not guilty of knowing about any of this.
Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent for NPR's Washington Desk. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Robin, we heard about Columbus, Ohio there. That is one of the 20 finalists for Amazon's second headquarters. Three of the finalists are in the Washington, D.C. area, the district itself, Montgomery County, Maryland, and Northern Virginia. And as each of those places tries to lure Amazon, there is concern from residents that governments will offer tax incentives that aren't worth it for taxpayers. Ali Schweitzer of member station WAMU reports.
At a restaurant in Courthouse, Virginia, members of the group Our Revolution Arlington are munching on appetizers and hatching a resistance movement against Amazon.
Thank you all for coming out tonight for our July Our Revolution Arlington General Meeting.
The group is a local chapter of a national progressive organization that grew out of Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential bid. The chapter has become the center of a growing bipartisan coalition of residents and activists raising questions about Arlington's pitch for Amazon HQ2. With support from Democratic Socialists, Green Party members, and fiscal conservatives, Our Revolution Arlington has asked the county board to reject any proposal that gives Amazon taxpayer-funded subsidies. Here's member Roshan Abraham.
Amazon doesn't need the money. I mean, Jeff Bezos is the type of guy that if he saw $1 million lying on the ground, it's not worth his time to pick it up.
Virginia and Arlington officials won't reveal what they've offered Amazon, but Maryland's bid has been made public, and it's offering the company the biggest incentives package in Maryland's history. The deal is valued at $8.5 billion, most of that in tax breaks. Officials there say it's worth the money because HQ2 could bring as many as 50,000 jobs and supercharge the local economy. Greg Leroy is executive director of Good Jobs First, a national nonprofit that tracks public spending on corporate incentives. He says there's no such thing as free growth.
I'm concerned that Maryland, with its obscenely large offer of $8.5 billion, has fallen into the trap of overspending for the deal. Overspending in a way that means taxpayers will never break even.
Showering businesses with incentives is nothing new. Governments have been doing it for decades, but analyses by Good Jobs First and the states themselves have found that incentives aren't always a sound investment. Maryland's incentives programs yielded an average of 55 cents on the dollar in 2016, according to a report from the state's Department of Commerce. Though the report says Maryland could see more returns in the longer term. And in Virginia, most economic development projects that got state grants between 2010 and 2016 failed to meet their wage and job creation goals. But Leroy says public officials keep subsidizing companies because they feel pressure to entice big business and create jobs.
And they got to play the game. And you've got to pony up and be competitive.
Christian Dorsey, vice chair of the Arlington County Board, says scoring Amazon would be a boon for Arlington and could produce lots of positive economic ripple effects.
In Arlington, we have a concern with vacant office space, which, you know, is in the millions of feet of square footage. And in order to fill that, that's certainly going to have to come from having businesses with large footprints locate in Arlington.
If the county gets HQ2, Dorsey says, officials will attach clawback provisions to any incentives so taxpayers can get their money back if Amazon doesn't meet certain benchmarks, like creating thousands of high-paying jobs.
We don't give away incentives. We don't give away density. We don't give away anything just because someone asks.
Economic development officials in Northern Virginia and Maryland declined to be interviewed, one citing a non-disclosure agreement signed with Amazon. But Roshan Abraham of Our Revolution Arlington says he worries that because Amazon is so big, it could use its money and influence to fight things like taxes and regulations. In Seattle, Amazon and other large employers waged a successful battle against a proposed tax that would have helped address the city's growing homelessness problem.
What we've seen in Seattle most recently is that Amazon's not going to play nice. You know, they're not good corporate citizens.
Amazon contests that. A company representative declined to speak on the record, but pointed to Amazon's charitable contributions in Seattle, including a homeless shelter it's building on its campus. The retailer has also said its investments added $38 billion to the city's economy between 2010 and 2016. Christian Dorsey says Seattle's experiences with Amazon, both positive and negative, offer important lessons to cities and counties in the running for HQ2.
No one, when Amazon started and began growing in Seattle, no one was thinking about these issues.
And he says if Arlington makes Amazon's whittled down list of finalists, he's prepared to help local residents get the best deal possible. For Here and Now, I'm Allie Schweitzer.
President Trump wants to remodel the FBI building in Washington. According to the news website Axios, Trump thinks the building is one of the ugliest buildings in the city. The building is an example of brutalist architecture. Concrete, stark, angular. People often either love or hate brutalism, kind of like cilantro. Joining us now is architect Mark Pasnik, who's a professor in the Department of Architecture at Wentworth Institute of Technology. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks very much.
And you and a colleague wrote a column defending brutalism and the FBI building after Trump criticized it. Before we get into the merits of brutalism, just describe what it is exactly.
So brutalism is a movement that's become associated in the U.S. in particular with concrete, although it didn't start only with concrete. But it's a movement from the 60s of architecture, which attempts to be very powerful images of buildings, bold, kind of forward-looking, oftentimes heavy buildings that tend to be quite controversial to most of the public.
Yeah. Now, does this movement continue today? Are people still building brutalist buildings, or is this just buildings that were built during the 60s and the 70s?
The movement really is, in fact, it starts really in the 50s, but takes hold in the U.S. in the 60s and into the 70s. I think it's a complete movement. I don't think it's happening anymore, but there are many architects who are inspired by it again today. And brutalism has come back into style in terms of the existing buildings. I think there's a lot of controversy about them, but there's also a lot of new interest in them. Recently, you could buy your brutalist-designed espresso machine and other kinds of things like brutalist wallpaper. So the market has really taken an interest in brutalism as a concept.
What gave rise to it?
Brutalism grows out of Europe, especially post-war Europe. The architect Le Corbusier, who is a very important international architect, French-Swiss architect, developed a series of buildings where he used very raw concrete. A lot of it had to do with the fact that this was the post-war economy. Steel wasn't available at the time, so he used concrete and it was rough, and he didn't treat it in a refined way. That then moved to the British scene, also post-war, where concrete was used extensively as a material. And in some respects, the philosophy behind it was to expose the raw nature of the material, to use the material, as the architects of the time would say, as found. So when you pour concrete into a wood framework, that framework can be expressed. And it shows you how the material was made. It shows you the characteristics of its construction. So brutalism really grows out of what the architects in the 50s called an ethic rather than an aesthetic. It was a belief that you should be honest about your materials. You should show them for what they are and those sorts of things.
Can you think of a good example of a brutalist building that is not made out of concrete?
Well, the very first one that the historian Rainer Banham calls a brutalist building is, in fact, a brick and glass and steel building by the Smithsons in the UK. It was called the Hunstanton School. So it's a very different kind of architecture. But what it did is it followed that ethic. It showed all of the materials. It showed the way things went together, even in roughness. And that's, you know, I think a characteristic that happens in most brutalist architecture. It doesn't try to coat over things or put flashy layers over something. It gives us the raw essence of the way the building was made.
I've heard from an architect who is a big fan of brutalism that maybe for some of the people who don't like brutalism, the reason is the concrete, not the actual ethic that you're talking about.
Yeah, or that maybe sometimes the forms can be very powerful and some might say oppressive if they don't like it. But I do think the concrete for many people that, you know, we have a lot of friends too who don't like brutalism, right, even though we're lovers of it. But they often complain about the darkness of the concrete or the character of the concrete as a kind of negative thing.
What are some of the other criticisms that people have of brutalism?
Well, I think a lot of the criticisms personally stem from the fact that many of these buildings are about 50 years old and they're in the cycle. Preservationists talk about the 50-year cycle for buildings. Usually after about 50 years, building systems are failing. They haven't been maintained properly. Mm-hmm. They're coming to the end of their first useful life. And that's the moment that we're looking at brutalist architecture right now. It's at the end of its first useful life. There are examples where you can see money being channeled into these buildings and making them better, and they're oftentimes much nicer, and the public likes them. The Barbican, for instance, is a very...
In London,
is a very sought-after residence in central London, and it's a brutalist complex. But it's had proper investment and reinvestment in its character and its qualities. Buildings that are often civic, like, for instance, the FBI building that Donald Trump criticized, are buildings that haven't been maintained properly over the years. There's so much deferred maintenance with these buildings that they're in terrible shape right now. And I'd add that that was true of Victorian architecture in the 1950s because it was heavy and dark and brooding and all these kinds of things.
But you're saying it's more of an issue of the upkeep rather than the architecture.
Well, I wouldn't say it's only the upkeep, but I do think that has a major factor into it.
Looking at a building from the outside is one thing. It's also, I've noticed, when you're inside a brutalist building, it can be rather dark.
Yeah.
It's not a big glass tower like we see now, all these places just being made out of glass.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the sides, the walls are concrete.
Yeah. And so there tends to be a kind of darkness that I think pervades them. Sometimes, for instance, if you walk into City Hall, I think it's much more like a cathedral than it is like an office building.
Yeah.
And it has that kind of quality of a medieval cathedral on the inside in some of those spaces because of the drama of the light. It's not a brightly lit corporate office building. It is a dark, and for some that can be a very negative character.
So what do you say to the haters of brutalism? Why they should change their mind?
Well, I don't think that they have to love brutalism to think that brutalist buildings should stick around. I think there's a lot of reasons to preserve brutalist buildings. They, first of all, are an important movement in the American scene of architecture. Secondly, they're existing buildings that have values unto themselves. They remind us of times when there were, for instance, civic investments in our cities that we don't do today.
Mm-hmm.
Third, there's the sustainability argument that these buildings, tearing them down is a terrible idea. That the best building is an existing building in terms of a sustainable future. So renovating them, transforming them, making them better, I think, is the best option. And there's really a wave of buildings that are starting to do that. If we look out our window, we can see...
This is a brutalist building right
outside.
Brutalist
building that's been renovated and transformed. And I think those are good models of improving the way people use the buildings. They're not faultless. I would definitely say there are some major problems. Some of them don't address their streets very well. Some of them are dark on the inside. Some of them are in terrible shape. But I think we can invest in them and return them to a kind of positive glory.
I remember a trip to Tel Aviv. I went into a neighborhood that was all Art Deco. You don't see entire neighborhoods that are brutalist.
Well, you might see complexes. So, for instance, our government center here in Boston or Albany's capital or Brasilia's capital, for that matter, are larger complexes that are made out of concrete architecture. And in Boston, we have a particularly broad tradition, and also in Washington, it's very similar. The two cities grew in the era when brutalism was popular, and so there's quite a lot of examples of it. Whether they're whole neighborhoods, I can't think of one beyond maybe Brasilia, which is, you know, the seat of government in Brazil, and which has an enormous amount of concrete architecture.
Would you agree that brutalist buildings are not very inviting?
Well, their intentions originally were to be inviting.
Really?
One of the biggest problems, I think, is that people have a very different reception of the buildings than the way they were intended. People think of them as communistic or as alienating. They were actually envisioned as being monumental symbols of how important the civic realm was. So if you want to represent government, remember, this is in the 1960s. So government was our friend. It was actually an era of the great society and the welfare state. Government was doing positive things for people. These buildings were designed in ways that they would be monumental to express that collective aspiration. I think we interpret them quite differently today because of who we are, not necessarily because of the buildings, but we have much less trust of government. You know, we live in a sort of neoliberal era where smaller government is better, where we don't want to spend too much on our buildings. All of these kinds of factors, I think, weigh into how we receive them today. Again, it doesn't mean that everybody has to love these buildings. I just find them fascinating. And I think the more people learn about them, they tend to also find them more fascinating. They may still think they're ugly, but they have a really important history and presence in our culture that I think shouldn't be done away with.
How would you describe the period that we're in right now? Is there an overarching theme to the architecture that you're seeing in 2018?
Well, it depends where you are in the world. Mm-hmm. I think in the American scene, there's less adventure than there is in the rest of the world, or I shouldn't say the rest of the world, but other parts of the world. The U.S. is driven quite a lot by development pressures and by cost. And what we're seeing is, I think while there is a lot of great work happening here, one thing that you'll see in contrast to brutalist architecture, it's becoming thinner and thinner. So buildings are often glass and steel. Mm-hmm. They're thin. They don't have a whole lot of depth to them. Their materials are thin surfaces. This has a lot to do with environmental concerns as well as economic concerns. And it's one of the reasons I love brutalist architecture is because it was built at a time where you could have really heavy, thick buildings. They have strong shadows. They have wonderful presence in many ways. And again, it's a reason why I think they shouldn't be lost in these arguments about what to do with buildings that are in tough shape right now.
That's Mark Pasnik, who is a professor in the Department of Architecture at Wentworth Institute of Technology. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks very much.
Pepsi's CEO Indra Nooyi is stepping down after leading the company for 12 years. In that time, she moved Pepsi beyond soda, buying up a hummus brand and a kombucha maker. But her departure leaves around two dozen women at the helm of Fortune 500 companies, a number that has been falling. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And we'll talk more about women in the boardroom in general. But first, let's talk about Indra Nooyi. She grew up in India. During food shortages in the 1960s, she came to the U.S. on a scholarship and made her way to Pepsi. How did she shape the company?
Well, I really think she had to come in at a very difficult time over the last dozen years. Obviously, consumer tastes have changed dramatically. And so she led a push into healthier, more nutritious products. You mentioned hummus, but she was looking at trying to spend more on research and development, trying to figure out what's going on with seaweed and the benefits of that and Ayurvedic medicine. So she really was trying to transform this company away from snacks and sugary drinks.
And they're still having a problem doing that, right? Because Americans are drinking less soda than ever right now.
Yes, and they are also looking at these smaller, trendier, almost customized brands that seem to break through out of nowhere. And I think that that's part of the problem is that all of the big companies and all of the competitors, whether it's Coca-Cola or Mondelez, which makes Oreos, they're all trying to figure out how do we compete with these smaller brands. In some cases, they just try to purchase those brands. In other cases, they can't keep up.
Okay, so her departure from Pepsi leaves just about two dozen women leading Fortune 500 companies. What percentage of big companies in the U.S. are led by women?
I'm going to tell you right now, teeny, because we're talking about Fortune 500. And I will say that it's even smaller as the companies get bigger. But you know what? Down the ranks of smaller companies, mid-sized companies, even family-owned businesses, there are far more women who are actually atop those kinds of companies. And we don't talk about them as much. I know they're not as big, but I don't want to make it sound like there's no women out there. There's plenty who are there, but boy, now in the past year now, we've got 13 women CEOs leaving. And so now we're at 23 in the Fortune 500, and that's a one-year decline of 25%. So just think, a tenth of the leaders of these companies just out of control, gone.
Well, and we think of Marissa Meyer, who left Yahoo last year, Meg Whitman, who left Hewlett-Packard earlier this year. Why do you think, as a woman yourself who's been covering Wall Street for a long time, why do you think that women don't rise up to the top levels of these companies, even now in 2018?
I think that we just don't have enough women coming up in even the upper management. And then when we go to look for CEOs or C-suite women, there are not enough in the pool. And frankly, this becomes self-perpetuating because boards and search committees are seeking people who have experience in the C-suite in a Fortune 500 company. Well, if there aren't as many women in that C-suite already, then it does become a process where you're selecting people who just look like everyone else. So we've got to get boards to be more ambitious, and we've got to get more women up the ranks and people saying, I don't just have to go to Harvard and I don't just have to go to Wharton. I go to a lot of different places to be a great leader.
That's Jill Schlesinger, a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
And we've been thinking a lot lately about borders. President Trump wants to fortify one.
I said right from the beginning, we're going to build a wall. It's going to be a real wall. See that ceiling up there? I mean, this is a wall that if you get up there, you're not coming down very easy.
President Reagan wanted to erase one.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Wars are fought over borders. People risk the unknown trying to cross them because, as these migrants from Cameroon explain, what's known back home is worse.
They want to kill us over there.
But borders are fortified to keep out the unknown.
This is Canada, right? I'm telling you right now, if you're crossing here, you'll be arrested, okay?
Borders are lines on maps, but they also exist in our imagination. There are books about borders, films like the classic El Norte.
Inspired by a dream.
Al Norte.
El Norte.
They traveled thousands of miles to get to a new land.
And borders are destinations, a notch on your passport.
I gotta get that southbound train tonight. If I don't get to the border, then all right.
But what if all borders were open? There are three types of borders, controlled, like ours with Mexico, closed, North and South Korea, and open, the entire Nordic region, and at one time, most of the world. Many scholars point to the early 1900s and post-World War I as the beginning of controlled borders. And those who want to go back to open borders say it's a human rights issue. Bioethicist Jacob M. Appel argues that treating human beings differently simply because they were born behind a different border is unethical. And open border backers also say free migration can reduce world poverty, by some estimates, producing $78 trillion in gains. All this week, we'll be looking at borders. Today, what is the economic benefit of immigration? Michael Clemens is an economist with the Center for Global Development. While not an open border advocate, he agrees loosening borders would double world GDP. Michael, you know that's counterintuitive because many against open borders say too many immigrants tear down an economy. So explain.
Borders are really interesting places. One of the most remarkable things about the world in economic terms is that what you earn depends mostly on where you are. The exact same person doing the exact same task in Haiti, coming to the U.S., doing the same work, same exact task in that job, can earn 6 or 7 times more in real economic terms just for doing the same thing. You know, they say that it's in the U.S. we say that for success in life, it's not mostly what you know, but who you know. In the world more broadly, it's not what you know or who you know as much as where you are. Mm. And the thing is that when a Haitian earns money in the United States, that's not charity. Wages aren't charity. You get paid wages because you're adding at least that much value to an employer and to the economy more broadly. So what that wage difference reflects is that those workers are enormously more productive in one place than the other, The flip side of that is when you block that person at the border, you take that potential economic contribution away. It doesn't just impoverish the migrant, it takes away the economic contribution that they could make to the world, which is the reason they're earning more money.
Yeah. Well, you and your co-researcher, Lant Pritchett, collaborated on this, and you found that a large percentage of people from Haiti, Mexico, India, who live above the international poverty lines, don't live in their home countries. So they're living, you know, in the United States or other countries. So the money that they're making that's reducing poverty, maybe they're sending it home, but it's certainly reducing their own poverty, may be at least as important as any economic change that actually happens within Haiti.
Absolutely. The vast majority of people who ever emerged from poverty who were born in Haiti did it by leaving Haiti. And that's nothing new. A lot of people, for example, in the United States have historical origins in Sweden. Sweden used to be a pretty poor country, and that's the reason why between 1860 and 1930, almost 20% of Sweden left permanently. They emerged from poverty by moving, and that's something that's in the family experience of a lot of Americans.
Well, and the analysis continues. They moved, but a lot of the money seemed to have been sent home, or at least something happened that put Sweden back on its feet, and you don't think of Swedes as migrants anymore.
The migration was part and parcel of Sweden's economic development, and that's certainly true for Haiti today. Haiti got a lot of aid after the catastrophic earthquake of 2010, but they get much more in money from relatives abroad than they get in foreign aid. It's a very important part of economic development at home.
But how does so this helped Sweden, is helping Haiti. How does it help Americans?
Well, the thing about those global economic gains from people going to places where they are more productive is that the huge majority of that happens in the country where they go. When Haitians come and multiply their economic productivity by 6 or 7 times just by working here, that's an addition they're making to the U.S. economy. So the huge, the lion's share of the overall economic benefit accrues to the country where they go.
Well, to explain that further, because the thinking is that wealthy nations, when they open their doors, citizens who already live there lose their jobs or see their wages go down because the workers who are coming in as migrants work for so much less and take jobs.
So this is something we have a very long experience with in the United States. For example, between 1882 and 1965, with immaterial exceptions, the U.S. banned all Chinese immigration. Mm-hmm. And it's very clear why they did that. They were afraid of Chinese people taking American jobs, somehow degrading American culture, and there were public health concerns, too. In 1965, that policy was completely reversed, and you can see that none of those predictions came true. So it's hypothetically possible for that to happen, but it's not like the U.S. doesn't have experience with claims of that kind and things working out very differently.
What about the claim that immigrants hurt the economy because they have more need for benefits and resources because they come and are so impoverished? They overwhelm schools with children who can't speak English. They drain the system and thereby hurt American taxpayers.
The vast majority of immigrants certainly do not come to the United States for public benefits. Immigration from Mexico collapsed right after 2006. Coinciding exactly with the collapse of housing starts in the U.S. because so many of them were working in construction. Nothing changed about welfare benefits right after 2006. What changed was jobs, and people more or less stopped coming. So that's a really strong indicator that people are coming to contribute to the economy. They're coming to work hard. They're mostly not coming for benefits. And there's a blue ribbon panel that was put together by the National Academy of Sciences of some of the best labor economists who study immigration across the political spectrum a couple of years ago. They did a comprehensive assessment of the fiscal effects of migrants. Do they put it more money into public coffers than they take out? And the consensus of all of those economists was that after a generation, that is including the children of new migrants, that fiscal effect is positive. Mm. So yes, there are some startup costs, but very soon children of immigrants and their children just look a lot like Americans, and Americans aren't costly to America. Americans are part of America, and they benefit America. In a much broader sense, immigration is an investment. It's not a handout. It's not just a cost. Like any investment, it can have upfront costs, but like any good investment, the long-term benefits enormously exceed those costs.
That's Michael Clemons, an economist at the Center for Global Development and a proponent of loosening border restrictions. Michael Clemons, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Of course, not everyone agrees with looser borders. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders in 2015.
What they are talking about is completely opening up the border. That was the question. Should we have a completely open border so that anybody can come into the United States of America? If that were to happen, which I strongly disagree with, there is no question in my mind that that would substantially lower wages in this country.
And others say the issue isn't the economy, it's security. But while there are borders that keep people out, there are borders that keep people in. That's the Bulgarian Women's Choir. Their recordings in the 70s made them cult favorites, but they couldn't cross their border to perform until the Iron Curtain fell. Their story tomorrow, here and now.
A new analysis finds that the next U.S. Census in 2020 could leave out millions of Californians. The Commerce Department announced in March that there will be a new question on the census about a person's citizenship status. A number of states and cities have sued, saying that non-citizens will avoid filling out the census. That would throw off the numbers and impact federal funding and state representation in Congress. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
So start by telling us about this analysis in California. What did we learn about how much the next census may undercount people living across the U.S.?
This was an analysis done by the Public Policy Institute of California, a nonprofit think tank. And it basically said that if you ask people their immigration status on the census, you could potentially undercount, as you said, millions of Californians who might be reluctant to share their immigration status. And why? Why wouldn't they want to share their immigration status? Well, maybe they are citizens who know undocumented workers. Maybe they're legal residents who aren't citizens, but they don't want to be bothered by ICE or caught up in the Department of Justice's dragnet. Or maybe they are, as you mentioned, people who immigrated into this country illegally. Now, in some of these tracks, the Public Policy Institute said you could have as much as 45% of residents not respond. That is an enormous number. And there are, according to the last census, about 15 million people of Hispanic background living in the state of California. 15 million. So the Hispanic population of California is larger than the total population of Illinois or Ohio. So any change to the census that undercounts this population is a really, really big deal.
And what are the implications of it? The census has been taken every 10 years since 1790. If you have so many that are undercounted, what does that do?
So the census determines state and local populations, and that has implications for, one, representation in Congress, two, votes in the Electoral College, and then three, the share of federal funding programs. So the census isn't, technically speaking, a political survey, a partisan survey. At least this is something that people like to say, something they often say in maybe a high-minded way. But as you can tell, it is very political ends. It determines who has the votes in Congress, who has the votes to elect the next president, and who gets money under some of the biggest federal programs in the country. So it's a very, very important survey, and the sort of survey that has historically been sort of on the razor's edge of not particularly partisan, but then every once in a while partisanship sort of infuses itself into the survey.
Well, we're talking about it now because of this citizenship question. The Justice Department submitted a request in March to the Commerce Department to add that question to the census. And in April, Attorney General Jeff Sessions had this to say to the Senate.
The census, I believe it's common sense and it would be appropriate to ask whether or not a individual being surveyed is a citizen of the United States or not. It had previously been in the census and remains a part of the annual survey that's done.
So, Derek, tell us about the history here. Has this issue come up in the past?
It has, but not in my lifetime, Jeremy, and not in yours either. The last time the census asked about immigration status in its general questionnaire was back in 1950. So this will be the first time that the question will be asked of all U.S. households in 70 years. Now, that said, you heard Sessions say something about an annual survey, and a reasonable question here would be, okay, well, if the government doesn't measure citizenship and non-citizenship population in its decennial survey, then how does it know how many citizens and non-citizens we have? And the answer to that is there is an annual survey called the American Community Survey, conducted every year, sampled from about 3 million households, that asks a lot more granular questions. The decennial census has historically been pretty broad for the purpose of making sure that everybody feels like they can be honest, because it's so important to know how many people live in each state and how and where should the money go to from these federal programs.
So as we said, more than two dozen states and cities have sued to stop this question from being on the census, including California. Its Attorney General Javier Becerra addressed the issue in March.
By including a citizenship question, which will diminish response rates, the census will not be able to fulfill its constitutional duty to count everyone.
So, Derek, where do we go from here with this?
It's really, really hard to know. I mean, you have two really, really clear arguments here. You have the Commerce Department, the Department of Justice, essentially saying, look, we need this data. It's important to know where citizens are, where non-citizens are, and this will help us enforce Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. But then you have a lot of mayors and a lot of left-of-center organizations, a lot of moderate organizations as well, essentially saying, look, we know what this is. This is a way to scare Hispanic populations into not filling out the annual survey, and that will have a number of results. First, it will apparently or seem to diminish the population of large American cities, which tend to be left-of-center, and it will diminish the population of more Democratic areas. And so even if you have the Department of Justice and the DOJ saying this is all about the Voting Rights Act, the fear is that this will have the effect of depriving Democratic areas, blue states, right, of not only representation, but also federal funds.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.